John 4, Jesus here is traveling from Judea back to Galilee. And if you notice, when Emily read that, it says he had to go through Samaria. Of course, he didn't have to because most Jews didn't. There's a deep enmity and strife between Samaritans and Jews. They despise one another. They vilify one another. And most Jews in that day would not travel through Samaria to get back to Galilee, even though it was a very direct route. They would go a very roundabout way through the Jordan Valley so that their feet would not have to touch Samaritan soil. But I like it. Our text says, but Jesus had to go through Samaria. He had to go through Samaria because he did not avoid the other. He did not despise the ones that his people despised. In other words, it was the them. These Samaritans were the them in the us versus them game that we as humans seem to like to play. Let me just say this off at the beginning. This really isn't our point. This is just extra. So you don't have to pay extra for this. You're just getting extra here. If we go through life without interaction with them, whoever the them is in our life, the ones that we are supposed to despise, then we will end up deceived by our own dishonest prejudice, and what we hate is really an illusion. Because what we've done is we've vilified this group, we've characterized them, we've stereotyped them, and what we hate is the stereotype, not often the actual person. And so our hate is actually an illusion. Is there a group you don't like? Have you sat down and broke bread with them? The text says Jesus had to go through Samaria. It's a long journey. He's been traveling since daybreak, now noon. So I've been walking, you can picture, maybe for 6 hours or more. It's time for a break. Jesus sits pretty weary down by Jacob's well near the town of Sychar. And he's kind of tired. Every time I thought about that, I yawn. And very tired, but this is the guy that walked on water. You know, go back now to Christmas, our Christmas gathering. This is the mystery and the wonder of the incarnation. Here's one who walked on water. Think of the last couple weeks what we've covered. Here's one who goes, submits himself to the waters of baptism, and the heavens are opened, and he receives the Spirit for humanity. This is the one who faces off with the evil one himself in the desert, and where the first Adam gave in to temptation, he resisted temptation on our behalf. And here's the one who sits with the religious elite, the know-it-alls of the day, and he causes them to rethink everything and be born from above. And yet he's worn out. So you got fully God, miracles, all this power to do these things, and then fully man, wow, I'm tired. So he sits, he rests, he stretches out. The disciples go in to get some supplies. I like to think they were getting chimichangas. Those are always good for a long walk. I just like that word too. Jesus is resting. He's thirsty. He has no way, though, to draw water. And there comes a woman from the village to draw water. And Jesus sees her and he says, "Can I get something to drink?" She's obviously taken back very simply for three reasons: a Jew interacting with a Samaritan, a Jewish, a man interacting with a Samaritan woman, and that this guy would be willing to drink from the same jar as a Samaritan. They had this Jim Crow thing going on. There were jars for Jews, jars for Samaritans. Jesus doesn't care about any of that. He doesn't get involved in that. And Jesus looks at her and says, "If you knew who was talking to you, you would ask me, and I would give you living water, and it would quench your thirst." And she kind of liked that idea. The more she thought about it, she says, "What do you call that stuff again? Living water? I'll take two. I don't have to keep coming back to the well and doing this routine every day. Actually, second thought, give me several cases of that." So Jesus looks at her and says, "Well, why don't you go get your husband?" Jesus is a rascal. "I don't have a husband." Jesus sees through what she is concealing. And he says, "Well, technically you're right. You've had five husbands, and the man that you're presently with is not your husband. So you're right. You've spoken the truth. You have no husband." And she says, I love this. She says, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." as you would if somebody just told you your life history like that. Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. And that begins a rather interesting discussion. We didn't read all of that. But this business of Jesus bringing up the kind of slightly embarrassing fact that she has been married and divorced 5 times, what's up with that? And I would offer you that there's no hint of judgment in what Jesus is saying to her. He simply observes it. He has a reason for it. We'll come back to that. But there is no judgment. Jesus just simply, he knows. Here's a painting I want you to see. Painting done probably by a French painter you might not have heard of, Redon. You say Redon, I say Redon. I've heard it several ways on the internet. But he was 1840 to about 1916. He painted this in 1895. It's called Christ and the Samaritan Woman. It's his masterpiece. I believe it actually, the original hangs in a museum in Frankfurt, Germany. But this one is very different than the other depictions of this scene. You can look up the woman at the well, and you can find lots of images, lots of drawings, lots of paintings, lots of people have done this. But this one stands out unique. And usually, the picture of the woman, or the image of the woman, is that she is young and about 25 years old. Now, here's one I like. This guy did all these kind of modern, like Jesus still looks ancient, but the people are modern. I kind of like this. It has a point. But they're a little weird, some of them. Like this one, like it tends to look like Jesus is asking them out for a date, and it's a little weird for me. And they tend to go this route. But I like this image because the artist has not depicted a young 25-year-old. I mean, hopefully you think about it, she didn't burn through all those marriages at 25, even though they got married young. We'll give her some credit here. He depicts her as a little bit older, and what you do, now look, you got to look at a painting. I know sometimes we're not educated in the art, and so some of them are like, man, feel like I could paint that myself, but look at her face. You look into her face, and you see, man, she's had a hard life. As you look at that painting, what else do you see? You see in the heart of Jesus rivers of living water gushing. And they gush forth from his heart, and they're offered to this woman almost as a bouquet. I love that. Jesus has the living water in him, and it gushes forth, and it comes out as a bouquet from his heart. Notice the woman's eyes. They're closed, like she has heard what he has just said, and she's taken a deep sigh, probably actually hoping that something that this strange Jew has said is true. And you look in her face and you're reminded that things fall apart. That's a line from maybe Ireland's most famous poet, William Butler Yeats. He has this very famous poem called The Second Coming. And in that poem, he has this line, and it looks like this: things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Well, back to the story in the Gospel of John. Why has this woman been married 5 times? And now no longer seems to believe in the institution of marriage. I mean, you can imagine she seems to have just given up on it. But why? We don't really know. Jesus does not accuse her, so neither should we as we read the story. Accusation, we've talked about this before, is actually the spirit of the Satan. And this is not what you and I were put here on earth to do. So we don't really know a lot here about her background. We just know that Jesus does not accuse her. When I see her, when I read the gospel, I'm very image, as you can tell, image-driven. So I hear the words of the gospel story, as Emily read, and now I see that image of her and look into her eyes, and you can almost picture that line written on her forehead, that things fall apart. Marriages fall apart sometimes. Jobs fall apart for people. Dreams, expectations that we had about life tend to fall apart. It happens. But Jesus does bring up the fact to her, like, hey, your marriage has fallen apart 5 times. Why does he do that if not to accuse her? And I think Jesus brings it up because he wants her to be honest about the reality of her life falling apart, to own it, to accept what is. So stark reality, not to shame her, if you will, but to rescue her. Jesus points out that her life is falling apart because of one reason. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men tried to put Humpty back together again. And Jesus says to her, I want to put you back together again. But to do that, you have to own and accept who you are. We've talked about this here before. I think the first thing needed in life for most people is the virtue of acceptance. Accepting who you actually are and not who you would like to be. Accepting also what does God say about you? I don't feel that way, though. I feel like a dirty rotten. What does God say about you? What does he think about you? Accepting that. Accepting our life that up to this moment, we've done this and we've made these decisions and they've had these corresponding consequences, both good and bad, and they have led to this moment in all of its reality and learning to accept that is it. I am no other. I am no less, but I'm that. And I think one of the first things engaging with Jesus is just to be honest. Don't try to hide. Be honest about it. Things fall apart. It's a universal experience that everyone encounters sooner or later in life. We've all had things fall apart. You've at least had plans fall apart. That's not very fun. Maybe a friend. I bet every person in here has had some kind of friendship that somehow just fell apart. And to this day, if you think about the details, you can't fully explain what happened. It just feels like it disintegrated. How many have had that experience? See if I'm lying. There was no even maybe necessarily big fight. It just kind of fell apart. It went away. Things fall apart. Families fall apart. Sometimes our health falls apart. Finances fall apart. Governments fall apart. We know a little bit about that. Our faith falls apart. Last week, we spent a lot of time with Nicodemus in this idea of like, you have to be continually born above. There's this continual turning in your life, not just this one time spontaneous experience, but we talked about the dark night of the soul. Some people go in that dark night of the soul and they never come out. The suffering's intense, the loss is intense, and the questions and the anguish are a heavy fog and they get lost and our faith falls apart. But if our whole life is characterized by things falling apart, then maybe we have to ask why. And in one way or another, it seems like it will usually be what Yeats said, the center can't hold. He said it like this again, things fall apart. I dig those glasses, by the way. Things fall apart, those glasses do. The center cannot hold those things together. So things fall apart when the center is wrong. So wouldn't you agree? Everybody needs a center, an organizing principle for their life. Everybody's got to build their life around something, something that organizes their life, that gives them a kind of orbit, if you will. Like we move through life, we adapt, we change, we make decisions, we face consequences for those, again, good and bad. But we always have this center, whatever it is. Now, because of the human condition, because of that which has befallen us, a lot of times we pick very unhealthy things to be at the center, to be the organized principle of our life. Now, in church, I would be wrong if I didn't bring up the usual suspects. Sure, and not even a question. These tend to be the usual questions. So a lot of people, sex is at the center. So this pleasure that consumes some. Money, people that have it, people that don't. People that are in debt who are always trying to get out of debt. People that they just constantly want more. They're trying to climb the corporate ladder to have this, to be able to here, to move here. Drugs, alcohol. There's a lot of people with a lot of pain, and so I'd like to rid myself of that, but I'd like to have moments where I don't feel that pain. So those are the usual, but also technology is very addictive. We have a serious opioid problem in this country. So self-image, self-centeredness, self-indulgence, self, these are common unhealthy centers for our life, some form of self. And these false centers, obviously, they can't hold. Eventually, given enough time, they will break down. Now, not to deny, though, I think we all can be pulled in that direction, but I think, you know, church, middle class, sometimes white, evangelicals, we think, well, okay, those aren't, we know, we've been taught all our, you know, those are bad. But even the more, think, noble centers, think of that in your life, are not enough to resist the inevitable entropy of life and death. So what is the center? Again, most people intuitively, they kind of look at money, they look at sex, they look at drugs, all that self-indulgence, and we kind of know ahead of time, well, that is not a healthy center for our life. If you base, that's going to break down. But what about the things that we consider more noble? What about family ties? You know, family's good, being close to family, always having family, being able to gather around family. For some people, national identity. Being American, being patriotic, being heavily involved in politics and the community around you. Those are not enough. They're not enough to hold all the different pieces of life together. The good things, family and country, they should be good things, but if you make family and country the center of your life, you now enter into this territory that the Bible refers to as idolatry. The center cannot hold and things fall apart. This is why Jesus will often challenge these idols. He challenges these very good things lest they become idols. Family, country, not bad things, but beware. And so he'll say sometimes these very provocative things. Unless you hate father and mother, you cannot be my disciple. And we hear that and we go, come on, Jesus. Like, I mean, that's what we're, the whole evangelical edifice is built on, right? Family values. Focus on the family. We look at that and Jesus, what are you doing? And Jesus isn't obviously instructing to hate our parents, sorry, Spencer and Chase, but he is saying there can't be any rival. Even your family cannot be at the center trying to hold everything together, or things will fall apart. They will become idols if you place anything in the center, in the temple of your soul, where God alone belongs, it becomes an idol, and that which was a good thing now is an unhealthy thing. Jesus, have you ever wondered this? Why does Jesus go around calling God Father? You know, some people say, well, that was just acquiescence to patriarchal culture. Eh, come on. You know, they lived in a culture. Jesus was in a culture in a time where, man, it ran like very smoothly. Like the Caesar's the top. He's the CEO. He runs the country. Everybody bows to him. But there's all these little governors and princes and people in place. Down to even the husband of the family functioned as a mini empire. It was called paterfamilias. So the whole thing was this beautiful running system where everything had a top, had a hierarchy, had a Caesar over it. Is Jesus just acquiescing to that culture? Actually, the opposite. Jesus is doing something like this. Who do you call Father? Who do you think calls the shots and is at the top? I call God my Father. He's actually challenging the notion of a patriarchal society. It reminds me a little bit of the story of Francis of Assisi. As a young man, he sold a horse and sold some cloth from his father's store, and he gave the proceeds to the poor. This was not the first time that he pulled this stunt, and so his dad is a little bit outraged at this point, and he thought he would shock him, so he brought him before a judge, hauled him into court, and had the judge demand that he restore the money that he had given to the poor. So what did Francis do? He said, I'll do that. And he stripped off all his clothes, and he folded them, and he handed them to his father, and he stood in the courtroom naked, and he said, now I have no father but God. Ouch. It's kind of one of those reverse, I'm going to get him, oops, no. Something like what Jesus is doing when he's calling God Father. He's challenging the dominance of patriarchal culture. Family, fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, children, extended family, cousins, uncle and aunts, all that's good. All that is intended to be a good gift from God, but family can't be front and center and control, or you watch, it will break down. So does that make sense? It's easy for us, I think, a lot of times to go, well, sex and money and drugs, these kind of addictive things, those can be idols. It's sometimes harder to go political party, national identity, how I serve the community, family. That's not as easy to see. And especially family, if it's a limiting realm of love for you. Like, here's my family. We get family together. I'm close to family. It's family. But beyond that, I don't know. That means we fail to love our neighbor as ourself. And Jesus seems to be saying here that only that which is eternal can be the center thing that holds all the disarrayed parts together. Which is another way of saying only God can occupy the orbitable center of our life. I said, well, that's easy enough. Only John Coltrane made Love Supreme. I love that. Only a love supreme for God can organize your life in such a way that your life doesn't end up in pieces. Now, it doesn't mean because God is at the center that there won't be difficulties at all, but there's something in there that always holds. I think I've confessed this to you before. I feel like the church, as a pastor representing the church, I feel like the church in America has done a disservice to the people in this way. That we haven't presented a very powerful gospel to you. Like we sometimes haven't really given good news. And because we haven't given good news, then it doesn't give the corresponding hope and joy and, here's the key, assurance of who you are. We haven't given to you. So here's what happens. Lots of people have their hand raised in worship. We love Jesus. I understand Jesus is the center of my life. It's Jesus. And then over here, this hand is reaching for something else to heal us. I understand Jesus kind of has made the ledger. I'm clean. I'm washed. I'm on the good side. My sins have been canceled. Jesus has gotten the Father off my back. But now we're in search of something that will actually heal our life. So our marriage struggles and our faith in Jesus really doesn't speak to that, because all it does is cleanse me and solve the instantaneous thing and get me into heaven. It doesn't fix the I am not. Doesn't fix it. And so we're obviously looking for something else to heal our soul. Again, it's like, over here, I really believe in Jesus. I want to, and the church has given me that much, but over here, I've got to find all these other things to fix it. Now, hear me well here, because I don't want to undermine. I know Bruce just spent 3 weeks with mindfulness. And I already talked to him today. I'm not trying to undermine any of that. So here, sometimes we got to do two sides of the same coin. You can read all the self-help books. You can hear all the podcasts. You can go all the conferences. You can read all the new material. And trust me, I try to with you, so this is no judgment. And they can assist you. I mean, there are areas in our lives that we need to learn to manage better. You can't also cover everything in church. I totally get that. But Jesus says the first commandment is not organize your life, get all that fixed, go back and get healing from all these past wounds, eat whole foods, exercise, find this or that meditation, go to this. Love God at the level of the soul activity where there's movement. It's love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You can't start anything anywhere else. That has to be at the center. Only that which is eternal and that has abided through the ages can be the center piece that holds all these different crazy floating parts and brings them together. And only God is eternal. So Paul, please hear me. Don't, like, we're doing these classes on the side, and Bruce did some great stuff with mindfulness and stuff, and we'll always, hey, man, this book's great. Not a problem. We need those too. Just a reminder of this has to be. The problem is these won't fix you either. You then turn these things into the center, and they fall apart, and you're disappointed, and you start the cycle all over again. We're trying to avoid some of that rat race. Here's how Paul says it. I want to read it to you. You know this well, though, but I want to read it again from the scripture. Here's how Paul says it. Paul writes to the Colossian church, and just in one little chunk, he says this. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. In him, all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible, invisible, whether thrones or dominions, rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. And then he says this. One of my favorite passages, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. You read something from a Buddhist and you're going, whoa, I resonate with that. Yeah. Oh, everything connects in him. Have certain other people encountered certain, absolutely, that we've missed? Absolutely. Because everything that you come across that is truth and that will find its way back to him. He is the cosmic glue holding all the pieces of the universe. Science, psychology, anything that you come up with, engineer, he holds all those pieces together. That's a big Jesus. That's different than the one who saves your soul so you can go to heaven. I don't even like that line. It saves your soul, but no, he saves you bodily, and he saves the stinking universe. All those desperate parts he brings back together. So we read Paul, we see that passage, we go, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. I agree with Yeats. But then I also agree with Paul and say, but Christ is before all things. Yes, things fall apart, but Christ is before all things, right? Things fall apart, family things, country things, political things, ideas, noble things. Things fall apart, but Christ is before all things, and in him, all these things are held together. Paul is talking about the eternal logos of God that John refers to back at the beginning of his gospel, the eternal logic of God. It's the only other passage. I'll just read you again. I know you know this, but sometimes it's good to just hear it again. John says this, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, he was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being, in him was life, and the life was the light of all people, and that light shone in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And the Word became flesh, and it lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. That painting somewhat depicts, I think, what John and Paul are saying. Here is the one who is before all things, who has entered into time and space as a particular Jew in Galilee, yet he is before all things. This woman is getting ready to open her eyes to behold the beauty of the Lord, to look right at the center, to look right at eternity, life, light and living water welling up, and it offers to her a bouquet of love and hope and forgiveness and grace, the possibility of a new beginning. The eternal logos of God, the very logic of God's divine love, has become the human being Jesus of Nazareth, so that you and I can know what it looks like when we live our lives with God and divine love as the absolute center. What does it look like to have the only thing that can hold all the parts of the universe together, God? What does it look like to have the logos of divine love at the absolute center of your life? Well, it looks like the life that Jesus lived. That's what it looks like. At Jacob's well near Sychar, Jesus offers this woman a new center, a new organizing principle, a new way of structuring her life. She doesn't need to build her life around yet another man. That doesn't mean she can have another man in her life, but she doesn't need a man at the center of her life. Why? Because Christ is before all things. He's before your plans, your dreams, your job, your marriage, your support for the nation, your determination to do social justice in the world. He's before your kids, and in him, all those things are held together. Jesus is telling this woman that the logic of God's love that she can observe in his life can also be her new center. And what's great about the story, and last week, isn't it? Sometimes, like, I like movies that end bad, but I need the good ones every now and then to realize there's still hope in the world. I can wallow in the darkness with Batman a little bit too easily. So I need those. And I like this because she seems to comprehend this. She becomes a joyful witness to Jesus. And the story ends, I love whoever painted, I love this scene. The story ends with the Samaritan people joining with this woman. We know, you can read it in your Bible, we know this truly is the Savior of the world. How cool, the Samaritan village is now saying, this Jew from Galilee is the Savior of the world. An entire village. Keep in mind, Jesus does no miracles here. Not what we refer to as a miracle. Not what we think about as a miracle, at least. I mean, no sick people are healed. No demons are ousted. No one is raised from the dead. No water to wine. All Jesus does is sit with the ultimate outsider for a Jewish man. All he does is sit with 5-time divorced Samaritan woman and takes a drink from her jar, recognizing that she too is created in the image of God and that she too is worthy of dignity, respect, and of course, as you read this, that is the great miracle. Right? What miracle can save the world? If all of you and I had healing powers and we went out and healed all the sick and crippled people, would that save the world? It would save the crippled and unhealthy people, but it wouldn't save the world. If you and I were able to go out and do these spectacular, like the temple stunts of Jesus, like we would do these spectacular, miraculous feats, would that save the world? Well, people would probably be entertained and astonished for a moment and then eventually flip the channel. What will save this world is this kind of miracle where one is raised and formed in a culture where you are taught to despise the other group. Think of all the check marks. She is a Samaritan. She has the false religion. She worships wrong. She's obviously under the judgment of God. She's a woman. She's a failure in life. She's divorced over and over again. Obviously, something's wrong with her. And instead of leading with that, Jesus sits, listens, and hears her story and accepts her as she is. He accepts her as she is, not as he would wish her to be. That seems to be the kind of miracle that saves the world. You can raise 1,000 Lazarus from the dead, and that won't save the world. But this kind of miracle begins to save the world. The Samaritans look at Jesus, and they see the logic of divine love that alone can be the center of life. If anything other than the logos of divine love is at the center, then things tend to break down and fall apart. And Yeats is right, the center cannot hold. But Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Amen.